It's worrisome to media watchdog groups who say that they like more independence on the airwaves.
GCI jumps into the television business. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the National Tribal Law and Order Commission has criticism for how the state works with tribes.
There is less respect for the concept of tribal sovereignty here than there is in other parts of the United States.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
GCI is purchasing three television stations, KTVA in Anchorage, KATH in Juneau, and KSCT in Sitka. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the company says it's the first of potentially more media buys.
David Morris is vice president at GCI. He says the deal has been in the works for about a year.
This is all positioning for the way the industry is trending anyway in terms of the technology and the way people access information.
Few doubt that. The Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism reports that advertising revenue for local TV stations declined in 2011, but ad revenue on mobile devices like iPads and Kindles spiked 23% that year. Companies want to advertise where the viewers and readers are, and more, that's on mobile devices. Morris says the company will continue to focus on the telecom side of the business for now, though the company expects to move further into the TV market in the future.
There will be other affiliates and other stations that might be thinking about working a deal. We've certainly seen that when we got into the cable business back in 1996, as soon as we made the acquisition. There were a number of smaller cable companies that was interested in acquisitions.
Morris would not say whether GCI initiated the purchases, nor would he say whether there would be layoffs at the stations. The company is bringing in former KTUU news director John Tracy to oversee the transition in the newsrooms. Brian Stelter is a media reporter for the New York Times. He says there's a national trend of media consolidation at the local level.
We've seen across the country groups of stations being bought up by owners, which over time limits the number of voices in a market. This has been going on for years, and it's worrisome to media watchdog groups who say that they like more independence on the airwaves.
Also worrisome to some, Stelter says, is what it means for ad rates.
Anytime we see a company buying up more stations, trying to consolidate its business, it brings up questions about whether they're trying to have preferential advertising rates, whether they're trying to make it easier and better for businesses to work with them as opposed to their competitors.
GCI's David Morris says the company would not receive preferential treatment on the stations it will soon own. Stelter says GCI's jump into TV is certainly a smart business move. People still rely on television for local news.
Increasingly, though, they're going to be getting more of their news from the internet and from mobile devices. And GCI has arms in all of those areas. You could imagine a future where these local television stations are streamed to mobile phones that are also provided by GCI.
And that, Stelter says, could be a model for other telecom companies and markets across the country. In Washington, I'm Peter Granitz.
The Tribal Law and Order Act signed into law last July created an all-volunteer Indian Law and Order Commission charged with creating recommendations on how to make life for Native Americans safer and more just. Two members of the Indian Law and Order Commission recently visited Alaska to gather information. They say all Alaskans would benefit if the state worked more cooperatively with tribes. Governor Sean Parnell says the criticism is unwarranted. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
Troy Ide is the former U.S. Attorney for Colorado, now in private practice and chair of the Indian Law and Order Commission. He's critical of the state of Alaska's approach to law and order for Alaska Natives.
There is less cooperation among governments, and there is less
respect for the concept of tribal sovereignty here than there is in other parts of the United States.
A review of state policies and court cases shows the current and two previous governors have either not acknowledged tribal sovereignty or fought tribal jurisdiction, even though the Alaska Supreme Court has upheld tribal rights in several lawsuits. Ide says the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971 didn't affect certain tribal rights, and the state hasn't any grounds for disputing tribal jurisdiction.
The idea that the state could somehow not respect that or honor that is absurd. It has to respect and honor that. It's unless Congress were to speak and do something different. That's been the law in the United States since long before Alaska became a state. And nothing changed subsequently in terms of 1971 or any of the subsequent congressional acts. Nothing has changed that.
Commissioner Carol Goldberg, a professor at the University of California, Los Angeles Law School, says in addition to child welfare and domestic violence matters, tribes could also exercise jurisdiction over land.
There are lands, including native allotments and town sites, that are federal lands in Alaska, which count as Indian country under federal law. And as a result of that, the tribes do have legal authority over those lands, whether they own them or not.
Goldberg says not only do tribes have the right to exercise broader jurisdiction, all Alaskans would benefit if they did.
In places where tribal courts are exercising more authority over domestic relations matters, the dockets for those cases at the state court level have been declining dramatically. So, simply on the basis of saving state taxpayers costs of administering a state judicial system, there is a benefit that extends way beyond tribal communities.
Governor Sean Parnell says he looks forward to seeing the commission's full report, but he says criticism of the state's relationship with tribes is unexpected.
We consistently work with tribes in those areas in transportation, substance abuse, domestic violence and sexual assault, health and social services, adoption issues, and parental rights issues related to ICWA, so the Indian Child Welfare Act. So I'll have to take a look at it, but I am a little bit surprised by it.
Ed Thomas is president and CEO of the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. He agrees the state works cooperatively in many areas, but he says tribes are constantly battling the state in court, often, he says, over unimportant details and in areas where tribal jurisdiction is well established in federal law.
Well, there's a lot of ways we can work on some of these legal issues if we don't have the Attorney General's office trying to adjudicate things on things that are decades old. We need to get up to speed on what other states are doing and try to bring us forward so we can work together.
Thomas says the state also successfully lobbied to exempt Alaska from legislation that authorizes increased funding and more freedom for tribes running criminal justice systems.
That would have meant a lot more resources to our rural communities had the state not objected to having our language in the Indian Law and Order Act.
Ide and Goldberg noted several other issues affecting justice for Alaska Natives: insufficient resources to address substance and alcohol abuse, rural law enforcement needs, and funding and training for tribal courts. Goldberg says Alaska Natives sent to Colorado or Arizona for incarceration come back more hardened, making their reentry into communities more difficult. The commissioner's report to the President and Congress is due in April of 2013. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, getting kids excited about high school in Bethel by making it more relevant.
I want to be a pilot when I grow up, like my dad, so I can explore Alaska.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
Elections are over, and candidates and political groups reported spending nearly $10 million on state races this year. But where did that money go? While a lot of it went to consultants and media buys, plenty was also spent at Alaska's brick-and-mortar stores. Hundreds of cups of coffee were bought for voters and volunteers. Thousands of dollars went to helium balloons, and a small fortune was spent on T-shirts and hats. But of all the businesses that profited from this campaign season, Alaska's print shop saw the biggest windfall. KUCB's Alexander Gutierrez has the story.
For the first time in about a month, the mood at Pitt Printing in Anchorage is pretty laid back. A few workers are putting together calendars in their production room, and Elton John is playing on the radio. But last week, it was mayhem. Robert Graves, the store's production manager, says the place looked like an ant farm with campaign material everywhere.
It was scurrying about at all hours of the day, all days of the week. And it was somewhat like a maze, making sure that we keep enough open for everybody to exit upon an emergency, but it is piled up and busy.
Campaign season is easily Pitt Printing's busiest time of year, and this October was their best month since 2008. According to reports from the Alaska Public Offices Commission, dozens of candidates used their services, and they made nearly $200,000 printing campaign materials. John Tatham owns a company, and he says that they do everything from banners to custom-made potholders, like the ones printed for Senator Mark Baggage 4 years ago. But their biggest business actually involves printing things that most people don't want.
We're responsible for a lot of that stuff you have jammed in your mailbox.
This year, they printed 500,000 mailers, about one for every registered voter in Alaska. And all that work takes a lot of manpower.
The political work that comes through here could easily be touched by 20 people before it goes out the other end.
Back in the printing room, production manager Robert Graves tells me that campaign season is to print shops what Christmas is to other retailers. It helps their bottom line and keeps them very, very busy. Working at a breakneck pace is actually part of the strategy. Since Pitt Printing is often doing work for rival candidates, Graves says that it helps if they can manage a one-day turnaround for most jobs. If you put out something attacking a candidate, usually their opponent feels pressure to respond as quickly as possible.
We do that on Monday, and by Wednesday we're mailing a retort to that, and by Friday we're mailing another retort to that. So maybe we're manufacturing two or three jobs out of that. We love to think so anyway, whether it's true or not.
And in that vein, Graves says that the work during election season is interesting. You get a unique little window of how people's campaigns are going.
And you also get a sense of who's got the most money to spend and how they're spending their money. Occasionally you'll see a piece and it's like, man, they sure could have spent their money better than this, or this is a really good argument. You know, agree or disagree, recognizing a good argument. But yes, you do get a little sense of the tight races.
But Graves says that the amount of money spent on campaigns can also be somewhat bewildering. While candidates are talking about how they're going to help boost job numbers, they're also creating their own separate election economy. And Pitt Printing is benefiting from that, even if it's only for a few exhausting months.
I'm glad they only do this once every once in a while. If I had to do this all the time, I don't know if I'd survive it. There's something about the political deadlines that during that time that just ramps up everything and puts a multiplication factor on it. And the only thing that allows us all to get through it is we know there's an end to it.
And while it's been fun, it's safe to say that candidates, donors, voters, and yes, their mailboxes probably feel the same way. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
Poor salmon returns in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough have cost recreational and sport fishing interests in the borough millions of dollars over the past 4 years. The Matsu Salmon Science and Conservation Symposium, a stakeholders group working to protect salmon habitat, met to share the most recent information on what is affecting local salmon runs and to update a plan aimed at improving the health of the fish stocks. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Alaska's wild salmon are so much a part of the landscape that it is unthinkable that they would not return with the summer season. But that is exactly what is happening, at least in part, in the Matanuska and Susitna River drainages. Of the salmon stocks of concern identified by the state's Board of Fisheries, half are from the Matsu, according to Larry Engel.
And when you consider stock of concern throughout the state of Alaska, there's only a dozen of them. We got six of them right here.
Engel sits on the Matsu Barrow Salmon Commission now, but he has a long history with the state's Fish and Game Department and 10 years on the Board of Fish. He says not enough is known about why some Chinook runs are not returning in many areas of the state.
As opposed to some kind of bad harvest practices in a given locality or some kind of a freshwater issue that's going on. But my guess would be it's occurring out in the ocean. It could be ocean related to the environment, but I would think that would be my priority area to look first to see if that's the causative effect.
But a lot can be done on the local level to help salmon. The Barrow Salmon Commission is one of the partners in the Matsu Salmon Symposium, a group working on updating its plan to ensure healthy salmon habitat in the Matsu Barrow. Experts from a wide variety of organizations met in Wasilla for 2 days of information sharing and brainstorming on the subject. The conclusion?
The biggie, obviously, is housing and urban development to our freshwater habitats.
That's Corrine Smith, Matsu Program Director for the Nature Conservancy and one of the symposium presenters.
So there's alteration of shorelines, there's filling of wetlands, stormwater runoff from impervious surfaces as we have more and more concrete and asphalt and we're changing where water goes.
She outlined the four goals of the salmon plan: to increase and protect runs, to mitigate threats, and to restore habitat. A 2008 plan has guided the group's projects so far. Now, with new information on everything from invasive plants to changes in ocean temperature, the partnership will work on an update. The Matsu area is the fastest growing in the state, but development plans don't always coincide with healthy fish habitat, Smith says. She says it'll take education to make the public aware of the importance of habitat protection.
Because everybody wants to live on a stream or a lake, and that can be done in a way that's not a negative impact to salmon.
Larry Engel says people lose the benefits of food and recreation that salmon bring as restrictions on sport fishing in the Matsu due to poor Chinook runs the past 4 summers caused lost fishing opportunity. He says the recent floods in the Matanuska and Susitna River drainages are certain to impact an already dire situation.
It looks bad. We've had several of our king salmon runs for the last 5 or 6 years have gone downhill, and we're starting to get now returns from poor escapements in the past, and so it's just even more complicated by a flood of a 100-year proportion that's just going to worsen the already bad situation our fish are in.
Engel says salmon runs were healthy before 2009 when they suddenly took a dive. A University of Alaska Institute of Social and Economic Research study done for the Matsu Barrow based on 2007 data put the economic gains to the borough from sport fishing between $63 and $163 million in one season. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
The need for safe housing for women and children in Alaska who have suffered from domestic violence has sparked a first-in-the-nation program to help meet the demand. The Empowering Choice Housing Program was created with $1.3 million in Governor Sean Parnell's 2013 budget, plus another million from Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's Federal Moving to Work program. Peggy Brown is the executive director for the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, the agency that partners partnered with AHFC to develop the concept. She says the idea came from group discussions prompted by the governor's initiative to address the high rates of domestic violence and sexual assault in the state.
Legal services and housing are usually the top two barriers to victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. So it kind of started with conversations in these work groups.
Governor Parnell has made addressing the chronically high levels of violence against women and children a priority during his administration. Kathy Stone is the director of public housing for AHFC. Stone says they will issue housing vouchers based on recommendations from the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault and member agencies across the state. When someone goes into shelter to escape violence, they may be referred to AHFC.
We don't really make any kind of determination about their status. We just receive the referrals directly from the network. I think there's a good level of trust between our two agencies, and also because they only have a certain number of vouchers, I think they're going to make sure that the people they're referring are really in the situation and are in need of the assistance.
Stone says of the more than 3,000 public housing authorities in the U.S., AHFC is one of only 35 that are designated as a moving to work agency, which means they can get waivers from the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development for new ideas, such as the Empowering Choice Program. She says in the past, subsidy programs used a complicated formula of issuing points for assessing who would get the vouchers first. The new program sets aside a certain number of vouchers that are then issued on the referrals of partner agencies.
First in the nation, and the only one that I'm aware of, and we're getting a lot of positive feedback and a lot of questions from other agencies asking us, you know, how we did it and how it's going. And, you know, it really just started, we just opened it to the public starting November 1. So all of the, you know, feedback isn't in, but we're really pleased with how it's gone thus far.
She says some states and municipalities have similar programs, but no other public housing authorities. There are 250 vouchers statewide. 115 are for Anchorage, and the others are spread across Alaska. Stone says the process is fast. After a referral, verifying income, and a background check, the participant gets the voucher, usually within a week, and can then shop for housing. Typically, they pay 30% of their income for rent, and AHFC pays the rest. Participants can receive the subsidy for 3 years. A companion program also launched on the 1st of November will provide housing assistance for young people aging out of foster care.
And one of the unique components to that program is each of these youth that are going out and renting a unit will also have someone called an independent living specialist. This is an employee for the Office of Children's Services that will work with them to make sure that they're successful in renting probably their first apartment ever, that they're understanding how to pay their bills, how to be on time for things, and hopefully how to transition successfully into adulthood.
Stone says the two new programs are a testament to the state's commitment to end the epidemic of high rates of domestic violence and sexual assault. Alaska consistently ranks at or near the top in the nation for violence against women. Links to information are at our website, alaskapublic.org. Alaska's high school graduation rate lacks behind the nation, and Alaska Natives are more likely to drop out of school than others. In rural Alaska, high school students who do graduate may not be sure what to do next. In the next installment of our Being Young in Rural Alaska series from the producers of Kids These Days, Mark Earhart looks at an idea designed to keep kids in high school by giving them a glimpse of their possible futures.
Usually this sound means it's time to pack up and move on to the next class. Not these kids, though. They are prepping for the ACT college admissions test, and they work straight through the bell. They come from villages across the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta to Bethel for a special program, one that's not just for kids with straight A's.
I've made mistakes, and I was actually failing high school for my first 2 years. So this is a great way for me to get started again and finish well.
That's Daniel Inman. He's a junior from Tuksuk Bay. He and his classmates are enrolled in accelerated math and science classes aimed at prepping them for college courses and eventual careers.
Right now, I'm taking a full year of Chemistry and Algebra 2 in half a year.
Not all village schools can offer the upper-level science and math classes students need for some college programs. So this program, called RANCEP, has its students split their time between their home villages, Bethel, and a summer session at UAA. For the Lower Kuskokwim School District, the college prep program is at the center of a larger idea, the hybrid high school. It's an effort that brings village students to Bethel for intense learning segments, ranging from a week to an entire semester, then sends them back to their villages better prepared for the next step. Assistant Superintendent Dan Walker.
The whole idea of a hybrid high school would be to find ways to have a positive effect on graduation.
And Walker says to do that, schools need to keep their kids engaged.
It's how do we go about creating that environment where kids, they want to be at school. And so it's not the only thing. You know, we have to have really high standards in reading, writing, math, science, social studies, all of those things. But what we're finding is that we also have to have these other really highly engaging, motivating activities for kids that keep them excited about school, and that's the whole idea behind this.
Another branch of LKSD's hybrid high school is the Aviation Career Education Academy, or ACE, a special week-long program that also brings kids into Bethel from villages across the region. Kids like Bruce Simons, a seventh grader from Tuxuk Bay.
I want to be a pilot when I grow up, like my dad, so I can explore Alaska.
Bruce and other students jump into the cockpit of an old plane used for instruction at the local flight school hangar. The ACE program is giving kids a chance to delve into how aviation works, both in the classroom and in the field. They are learning about everything from the right conditions for flight.
If there's turbulence, you can't fly. Look at the forecast before you take off.
To how to actually put wings on a plane. Andrea Pachevinsky directs the ACE program.
We have 23 students this year, and we had well over 84 applications, so lots of interest.
She says students were picked based on the essays they wrote, not just the grades that they've made. Again, Dan Walker of LKSD.
We know that aviation is huge in the YK Delta, and we've got lots of kids who are interested in aviation careers.
And that's the reason Walker says the hybrid high school has been a success. It puts kids that have dreams of growing up and being a doctor or a pilot the tools to learn how to do that. Kids like Daniel Inman.
It's given me my motivation back, and it's made it so I want to succeed, and I want to get to college, and I want good things for my life again.
Similar programs to LKSD's hybrid high school are in place in Nenana and in the Nome and Bering Strait school districts. Reporting in Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Ellen Lockyer in the Mat-Su Valley, and Mark Earhart in Bethel. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Winter in Alaska can be tough on children and adults with asthma. Cold air and smoke from wood stoves is hard on the lungs. More time is spent indoors with dust, and colds and flus are common. Take care of yourself and loved ones with asthma during these colder months. Get a flu shot. Talk to your health care provider about asthma management. Take daily medication and know what can make asthma worse. For more information, visit asthmainalaska.org or call 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.